The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today we will be talking to Vijo Varghese about his organisation Our Land, located in Thailand, as part of our mini-series on biodiversity. Today's episode is hosted by Zeke Tinney. For meeting me today. It's really nice to meet you. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
So my name is Vijo Varghese. I'm one of the co-founders of an organization called Our Land. And Our Land's primary objective is to increase wild spaces and to further promote human-wildlife coexistence. So what we primarily do is we acquire pieces of land. We live on that piece of land. We try to live in sync with the wildlife around us as much as possible. As of right now, the plot that we have is a wildlife corridor. That's about that. I've been here for about 5 or 6 years. I used to be working in the corporate world before, and then I decided to quit that about 6 years ago. Now I've moved here 6 years and couldn't be happier.
I'm glad to hear that. It all sounds really interesting.
Yep. Super fun. Super fun. I can't complain. Maybe about the internet sometimes, but generally can't complain.
That's fair enough. I mean, when you're like using the internet out in the forest and stuff, I can't imagine it's good.
Exactly. It is. It's just a little difficult when you just can't watch your Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to start this organization?
Wasn't exactly an active decision in the beginning. The decision initially was just to leave the city, not to actively leave even. It was just to kind of find a place to do something on the weekend. I used to spend a lot of time on the weekends anyway, outside of the city in national parks, but I wasn't able to connect to the land. So I wanted a piece of a land in which I could kind of say that, you know, this is a jungle that we can do something about. We can make it better. We can plant trees. Things like that. So that was the first step towards it in that direction. A year after we leased the land, things didn't work out in my workplace. So I left. And then I moved here right away. I didn't look for a new job. I just thought I'd just kind of like go at it for a few months and then look for a job later. And then the rest is history. I kind of left the place. I came here. And then 3 months later, I looked back and I was like, oh my God, it's been 3 months. So I thought, okay, I guess this must be the right decision if 3 months later you haven't realized that 3 months have gone by. So yeah. So that was like the first primary trigger to state that, okay, this might be the right decision to not be in the city.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's always nice being able to like connect to nature. Just being in a place where you're surrounded by trees just makes all the difference.
That's true.
So what problems are you specifically trying to deal with your organization?
I guess one is just generally lack of land space for wildlife, which is like a worldwide problem. Destruction of wild habitats is a problem. That I guess would be the primary problem. And then I think within that, the secondary problem that we're trying to solve inside that is to allow human coexistence in that wild space. So everything from, from shelter, water, food production, energy production, how do you sustainably source all those four things in such a way that you don't have to like, so I guess in a way it's basically a solution for the world current issues, which is number one, dwindling habitats for animals and population rise for humans. So how do we kind of solve both those issues at once? You've got to have humans who are okay living in wild spaces, and you've got to create more wild spaces. So you include things like agroforestry, and the jungle itself is a food source for you. Right, so things like that really need to become part of mainstream life for people who want to live outside of the city, and hopefully there will be lesser people in the cities. Yeah.
How do we like really reclaim those spaces as spaces for wildlife to inhabit?
It's a good question, I guess. I think number one, the good thing about nature is that it pretty much takes over any place that you give it. If you just take a piece of nature and you just leave it there, it will take over just by itself, right? Mm. And that's even the city. Even if you have a plot of land in the city, automatically you know that over some time, things will grow on it, plants will come on it, you know, birds will poop on it, there'll be worms, there'll be bugs, everything. You know, things will just take off by themselves. And the best kind of regeneration, they say, is the one which humans are not involved in. Nature is just doing its own thing. So I think that's always a good start to keep in mind with. But in our case, we're trying to protect a piece of land that would make life for wildlife a little easier. So in our case specifically, there's a big wildlife preserve nearby, and it's difficult for the animals to access a river nearby because the land in between the reserve and the river is private land. So how do we connect the two, become a corridor, and make life easier? So I think that's a good starting point for it to locate. I mean, if you're looking for a how to for somebody else to do this, maybe locate a jungle, the closest jungle that you can. Look around for spots of land nearby the jungle, and then go and live on that land, and then kind of, you know, make the land better. I think that would kind of be the first step on that would be that. Of course, along with that comes all the issues of land acquisition. How are you going to allocate funds? How are you going to get the money? How are you going to live off the land? How are you going to make any income off the land? So stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds a bit complicated.
Definitely. But fun.
So is there anything in particular that you guys do to protect the corridor to help the animals get to that watering hole?
I guess one of the things is we actively make sure that no one's cutting trees in the area, right? We don't own all of the corridor. We only own a part, like about 12% of the corridor. Mm-hmm. So it is not easy to kind of go up and tell people that you can't hunt, you know, you can't trap animals. We can't do that because it's not our piece of land. But definitely that by protecting the land itself, and we have a fairly big, wouldn't say a great big chunk, but like a somewhat big chunk of land. So therefore protecting that piece itself, kind of people already know that, okay, you're not supposed to go there because they don't allow you in or to get in there. So I think that's definitely one thing that we do. And we make sure that we don't disturb the animals as much as possible, especially elephants, which go through. So usually elephants are, you know, either people throw firecrackers at them or, you know, shoot guns into the air, stuff like that, that tend to scare the animals away, scare them. And our idea is to keep it as peaceful as possible inside the reserve so that they kind of actively connect that, oh, this space is a space in which I'm not attacked or disturbed. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of go through if I want to. So elephants and animals in general do have that memory. You know, it's just things that they, you know, they're a lot smarter than what we think they are. So therefore, you know, they do have the ability to like to remember that and act on that. Now,
so how important is it to the planet that we rebuild our forests?
That's an obvious, absolutely crucial. You got 10 years before we go 2 degrees above, and save ourselves as a species. But to specifically answer your question of how important is it to the planet, I don't think it's important at all, right? Because the planet's totally fine. It's been here for 4 billion years, right? And we are just a bunch of tiny, you know, humans who are like, in considering the time span of the existence of the planet, we are barely a nail file of time period on this planet, right? Mm-hmm. And what is it, 4 billion years, you know, and then you have Homo erectus at 3 million years, 4 billion, 3 million, And then you have Homo sapiens at 300,000 years. So, you know, so that's a really, really small amount of time that we've been here. So therefore, is it important for the planet? Absolutely not. It's just it's more of us, let's say, us testing our own ability to know if we are smart enough to evolve, right? Mm-hmm. But not just smart enough to evolve, smart enough to evolve and smart enough to actually, you know, to solve this problem, because it's not something that's just turned up now. It's been turning up it has been in this way for the past, let's say, about the past 5 to 10,000 years. Ever since we started agriculture, we started changing the carbon cycle. Seeing that we met through the carbon cycle 1,000 years ago. So the other generation looks at us and says, oh my God, it's us, it's us, we, it's us. We gotta do all this. We gotta stop eating avocados, and make sure that plastic is all recycled, and we shouldn't use plastic, and all that's great. But this is actually a tricky problem to solve, because it goes back so much in time, right? And we've built so many systems upon each other that then lead to where it is right now. So does the planet need us for the planet? How crucial is it for the planet? I don't think it's crucial at all. It'll just erupt into a few volcanoes, you know, kill a few million humans, billion humans, and then settle itself out. But is it important for us? I think it's important for us to, as a species, to kind of look back, you know, because this is not something that we'll solve right now, right? This is something we'll look back in a few hundred years and then say, remember that time when we had that, you know, that climate change thingy that was going around. So it's very similar to, I think, very similar to in the 50s 40s 50s 60s, there was a huge food problem. There was a massive food crisis, because we had a population going up, and there was lots of prediction that's going to be lots of death all around the place, and so not going to be enough food. But we found industrialized agriculture, and we saved ourselves, right? But we didn't realize that was going to kill us later. But but yeah. So technically, planet's fine. We're in shit. We need to outsmart the whole thing. Yeah,
that's a really interesting perspective. To be fair. I liked hearing that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you guys prioritize agroforestry, farming, which attracts wildlife like elephants and deer closer to human settlements. How beneficial is it to close the gap between wildlife and humans?
We really need to integrate the idea of integrating wildlife into human life, right? The way we live our lives. It's not just about, because I think that we have a usual misconception that when we think of wildlife, we think of megafauna. We think of deer, we think of, you know, or the, you know, large fungivores, or the large, you know, this thing. So we think of elephants, we think of deer, we think of, So that's the kind of creatures we think about. So of course, having those connections are definitely very key, that we are, you know, accepting of their space and willing of their space. I think what's kind of really, really losing out is how children are losing the connection that they have to nature, right? And biophobia is one of the clear examples that is going to be the primary cause of habitat destruction worldwide in the next 50 to 100 years, right? And biophobia is the fear of anything bio, right? So every time you have children, you know, going into the jungle, taking children into, I encounter this all the time, right? So someone sees an earthworm, like, oh my God, earthworm. So I think that kind of mentality and the idea of just touching dirt being full of bacteria and viruses and like fungus and, you know, so that kind of thinking, I think that is what needs to be dealt with at education at a very lower level, at children at a very young age. Because if they are not, in sync with this kind of a connection to nature, They simply will not want to protect nature. So come when they grow up, it's time to pass a bill on setting up a new national park, which is crucial for the environment, crucial for our own survival as a human species. They don't want to push it because they're like, it's icky. It's disgusting. It's like, I don't want to, why would I want to protect the national park? I don't even want to go there. You know, that kind of thinking needs to change, I think. I think that's kind of also part of the coexistence factor. So when you see worms or you see bugs, your first instinct is not, how the hell do I spray the hell out of these things and kill everything so that I am like completely just free of creatures and bugs around me. So like, I think that's definitely of a much higher importance, because to some extent, the bigger animals, we can easily kind of like, you know, we can, because they're so big and they're so wow, it's easier for us to say like, oh my God, elephants, and like be okay with them, right? But what's not okay is when like a snake or a skink or a lizard goes by and you're like, ugh, to kind of get rid of that feeling, right? So yeah. So I think that is where the key lies in terms of the coexistence at that level.
Yeah, absolutely. I think growing up in like surrounded by trees and forestry and animals and wildlife really is beneficial to anybody growing up, just to make you more comfortable with nature and the world around you. And I know that a lot of people who grow up like in the city and stuff really miss out on that part of it and struggle to reconnect with nature later in life because of it. So you often rescue and rehabilitate snakes and try to alleviate the fear of snakes through education to your local community and international groups. Why are snakes such an integral part of the ecosystems in Southeast Asia?
I guess two parts to it. I mean, number one, they're just basic pest control, right? So they keep the rat populations under control, right? If you kill too many snakes and you get too many rats, then you got to kill the rats. So, you know, that's kind of a flow of things. And I think that, so it's kind of difficult, like, because the fact is there, snakes are carnivores, right? So carnivores are basically playing a very important part in check of the herbivores that are at a higher level, since it's a triangle setup, right? So you kind of want to ensure that carnivore is in place, because when you knock one carnivore off, right, it's like the wolves in Yellowstone, right? When you knock off one carnivore, then you have a whole bunch of other issues and the whole landscape starts to change, right? Like when they reintroduced the wolves in Yellowstone, total landscapes near waterways and everything just completely changed, because suddenly the wolf was there just eating the deer, you know, and the deer were not eating the tiny little plants that were growing, and suddenly there were more of those plants and suddenly waterways, and the whole place changed, right? So I think that in that way, maybe we haven't really fully studied the impact of removing the snakes out of the picture. But personally, I also feel that it is, I mean, I guess I'm fortunate enough to be a person who likes such deadly creatures. but I think it's more to a large extent, it is kind of a reflection of the fact of how much compassion can we show as humans, right? So, and in Thailand, there is a deadly fear of snakes because of very deadly snakes like the pit viper and the cobra and the king cobra and the Russell's viper. These are all really deadly snakes. And I feel that when you tend to be able to show that kind of compassion to the snakes, to those creatures, I think that's a very high form of humanity, right? So, and almost like the tiger, I guess, right? Like we know the tiger can kill us, but yet we want to protect it. We can just want to be in its own space, like just stay in the jungle, but like, but I really want to protect you. Everyone has that kind of like, you know, everyone has that. And but with the tiger, it's more of a glorified, you know, everyone like, oh my god, a tiger, it's so cool. That's the mentality people have, right? But no one's ever encountered a tiger up front. Trust me, I've been up close with them, you know, even, you know, captive tigers, and they are scary creatures. Like, that is one big deadly cat. So, you know, so I think people forget that aspect, which is okay now, and they want to protect the tiger. But it's the same with the snake, I guess. And like, but with the snake, people just still have that fear. So I think it's more about, one is definitely important in the system, in the pyramid of things. Secondly, it's a sign of compassion from humanity to be able to show that love for the creature and to protect it. I have to say that I find them absolutely beautiful, right? They are definitely like one of the most beautiful creatures of nature. Just, and I find it so amazing that the snake evolved after the lizard. You would think that the snake evolved and then the snake evolved into the lizard. Like,
yeah,
you know, I was a snake. Oh, I might want to pop some legs out, and it pops some legs out, and then you become a, you know, it went the other way around. It was a lizard that after some time said, you know what, I want to become a snake. And then the lizard became the snake. So it's an interesting evolution of things. And I guess that with the snake people, I call myself snake people because there's a few of us out there. We're like, just right from the beginning, there's some kind of a connection to the snake world. Mm-hmm. We're just, I guess, very attracted and very attracted to snakes somehow. Maybe it's got to do with the need for evolving, because if you look at ancient cultures, every time they say talk about snakes, it usually is when you're talking about resurrecting your life, or there's life going through resurrection, or just, you know, becoming a new person. So maybe that's something got to do with my life, but who knows? That's all philosophical talk. But yeah, but snakes are cool.
Snakes are cool. I really like snakes as well.
Do you have any snakes there besides the adder, right? You have the
pop adder, I think, right? Yeah, I think we have an adder, but I don't actually know if we have any other types of snake. But I know a few people who have snakes as pets, and I think that's pretty common in England. Not common, but, you know, uncommon.
Yeah, but I mean, I think one out of every 100 person will have like a weird pet, and absolutely, snakes or something.
Definitely. Right. Okay, well, I've got one last question for you today. Yes. So what does sustainability mean to you?
Wow, what does sustainability mean to me?
A big question, I know.
I know, that's such a, I mean, there's always that, there's always the traditional explanation, right? It's like, so that you can use and make sure that future generations can continue to use. This is a really tough one, because I think to me, it's about the connection that you have with your environment, to a large extent. I mean, like I said, putting aside the traditional, you know, I can use, my great grandkids can use too. That's a traditional explanation of sustainability, right? But I think it's about, to some extent, being connected to the environment around you, so that you are in some way aware of some extent where all the stuff that you use is coming from. Right. And I know it's very difficult to kind of go back in time now, because we've gone way past that stage already. Supermarket, buy everything you want. I don't know where. Well, the fun fact is, just 100 years ago, you possibly would be able to know about where 80 to 90% of all the things around you came from. You know, fast forward, say, you have less than 10% of an idea of where all the things around you came from, right? Mm-hmm. And so while connecting to nature, I think it's about having the compassion to connect while you're connecting to nature. So what I mean by having compassion is, so when you think of food, you know, you've got to actively think about like, oh, well, food is basically got to come from compassionate source. What does that mean? That means that I don't want to kill everything around it when I'm growing the food. I want other things to live, too, right? Water, where am I going to take the water out that to make sure that the planet is able to produce that water in a cycle, and maybe not from an aquifer deep underneath the earth, and I don't know who's going to, if it's going to be there in the future. That's another one, right? The shelters I live in, am I going to, I mean, literally, does that mean that someone has to blow up a mountain, crush it to bits, and then put it in a package, and then I got to mix it with water and then bake concrete houses, right? Mm-hmm. So, and energy, and I think there's no simple answer to this. And that's the hardest part about it, because sustainability is such a complex concept, so because it's so interlocked with carbon, right? It's so synced up with carbon, because it's all about, I mean, to a large extent, it's about carbon,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, you know, you can, what are we, how can we displace the least amount of carbon in what we're doing in our everyday life, right? And so therefore, I think that their compassion is a huge part to play in that. And take the time to think about it. So, taking some time to, I guess people would say slow down, right? Just to slow down in life and just to kind of think about the things in your life. But I really don't think it's just about slowing down, because I don't think it's, people think of it as slowing down, as if being fast is the way to go, you know? So, and being fast, I think, is just a simple reflection of internalized capitalism, right? When we internalize capitalism, what do we have in our mindset? We have the mindset of, okay, I've got to keep doing something all the time. I've got to stay productive. I got to wake up. Oh my God, I've got so many hours of free time. Okay. I can only rest at like 6 p.m. That's when I got to rest. That's when I'm going to chill out, right? I can't do that before. Have I prepped for my day tomorrow? So the inability to rest, you know, and the idea that we constantly need to be doing something to be gaining something, to be acquiring something is always there.
We're
constantly in that mindset, right? And why is it there? That literally is capitalism, because, you know, I mean, capitalism has led, not that I am against the idea of using money, I'm not talking about the very concept of capitalism in the sense of the idea of constantly wanting to buy things. It's almost like capitalism and materialism almost like on the verge, kind of mixed up. When you have that, materialism is basically led to advertising. So advertising is constantly always telling you that you're unhappy, right? So if you're told that you're constantly unhappy and the only way for you to be happy is to buy that product, you know, or service, that's what leads to that sense of speed, that you're always like, I got to be going, I got to be doing that, because I've got to keep acquiring, I've got to keep this thing. And so when you kind of let go of that idea of internalized capitalism, you take it out and you're like, wait, I can just be without those thoughts. I think that's kind of where sustainability kind of comes back into the picture, because then you're suddenly like, oh, these, I don't really need all these things. Like, you know, that, and then you start being more compassionate. And I think sustainability starts to come back into the picture there. And all those things, you know, it's food, energy, water, shelter. This is what we call what I call the four core pillars of sustainability, the very absolute core, right? And I think that, I guess that's a very confusing around the world kind of explanation of what sustainability is, but there you have it.
I really like that explanation. It was really, really in depth.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. All right, then.
Thank you very much.
All right. See you soon, then.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Vijay Varhees from Ireland, for talking to us about biodiversity and their important work. Organized by Jasmine Barrett and Zeke Tierney. Music by Billy Painter. You can find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org. Thanks for listening.